Okay. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to our final installment of our series on Megillat Rut. I've really enjoyed it a lot so far. I hope you have as well. What I want to do tonight is both summarize what we've done in the previous shiurim and to bring them all together to show how each of those shiurim all together is greater than the sum of its parts. And what we'll do is we'll try to revisit each of these shiurim in light of another book, in light of Sefer Shoftim. Sometimes when you read biblical narratives, you know, you could read them alone, independently, and they have their own meaning. But sometimes you need another book or another narrative to kind of help you really understand what's going on in the local narrative. So for example, when you read the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua and you start thinking about all the things Yehoshua does and how they compare to Moshe. Just for example, Yehoshua sends not 12 spies, but only 2 spies. He does it quietly. When you see the differences between Yehoshua and Moshe, it really helps you understand Yehoshua a lot better. And I think that Megillat Rut is one such example of a book that attains a lot of new meaning when you read it in light of another book of Tanakh, namely Sefer Shoftim. I want to begin by going through with you just the first pasuk of Megillat Rut, and just we've seen it before, but I want to look at it again and revisit it. If you take a look over here, it says "Vayhi bimei shvod hashoftim," and it was during the time that the judges judged. Now, in the past we've discussed how it's interesting why they don't provide us with further information. Which judge are we talking about? Are we between judges? And there's a lot of debates about that. But what's most important from what I want to derive here is Vayhi bimei shvod hashoftim, that we're in the time of shoftim, the time of judges. Now, what we can ask is the following. This book is in Judges. So why is during the time of judges? So why don't we say that it should actually be part of that book? Right, pretty simple question. You have a story that's during the time of Sefer Shoftim. Why not actually include it in Sefer Shoftim? To further bolster this question, if you think about Sefer Shoftim itself, the book of Judges, it's not like Sefer Yehoshua or other stories where there are sort of set narratives continuing throughout. Sefer Shoftim is a bunch of individual stories. They connect. It's this downward spiral, but in Sefer Shoftim, you have at the beginning one shofet and then another shofet. So, for example, you could fit in this story maybe between Gideon and Yiftach, or put Avimelech and Yiftach, or you could put it before Shimshon. Meaning, you could put this in somewhere. It's not a problem to stick in this mini story elsewhere in Shoftim. It's 21 chapters. Add a couple more. Not a big deal. So, our second question is, why isn't this in Shoftim? One, it's the same time period. Two, it wouldn't have really broken up the book. The third very interesting point is that who actually authored these two different books? If you take a look at source number, the second source here, in Masecha Baba Batra on Daf Yudal Amabet, the Gemara there goes through all the authors of the different books of Tanakh. And here it talks about the Ketuvim, the writings. And it's actually a very interesting section there. But so it talks about Rut. So it says, Sidran Shel Ketuvim, what's the order of the Ketuvim? So it puts Rut first, probably chronologically, for the chronological reasons. And it says, Rut B'Sefer Tehillim, Umi Katvan, who wrote these books? Shmuel Katav Sifro, so Shmuel wrote Sefer Shmuel, B'Shoftim, and he wrote Shoftim, and Rut. Shmuel wrote both of these books. Now, it's a little questionable that Shmuel actually wrote all of Sefer Shmuel, primarily because Shmuel dies at some point during Sefer Shmuel. It's a little hard to believe that he wrote the whole thing. Maybe Moshe Rabbeinu had that type of foresight, but a little challenging with Shmuel. Also, even in Sefer Rut, in Megillat Rut, there are indications that it was written from a much later perspective than Shmuel. But even if that's true, I think that further supports our question, which is if the Midrash is trying to associate both of these books with the author Shmuel, then why not bring them together? It's not one author wrote this, one author wrote that. That's why not to group them together. But Shmuel wrote both of them. So I think our question stands again. Why not put this in Megillah in Sefer Shoftim? I think the most simple answer to this question is that Megillat Rut is a totally different type of story than what we find in Sefer Shoftim. Sefer Shoftim is this very negative time. There's a lot of warfare, a lot of battle. Whereas Megillat Rut, it's, you know, all's well that ends well. It's very idyllic scene. You know, all loose ends are tied up by the end of it. Rut gets married. Naomi has a grandchild. Things are very positive by the end of the book. Whereas Shoftim is a totally different genre. I think that's probably the most simple answer. But if that's the case, that it's just different, I want to raise a different question, which is that why do we actually care that Megillat Rut took place during the time of the Shoftim? I mean, it's clear from the Pasuk, Vayihi Bimei Shvot HaShoftim, that the author wants to put it into the time of Shoftim. But why does that actually matter? If you think about it, this story could have happened in Yehoshua, it could have happened in Shmuel, it could have happened in Malachim. What would have changed? It's still the same story, the same family, the same chesed, the same acts of valor by Rut and Boaz. What actually changes by it being in Sefer Shoftim? Seemingly very little. And yet the author feels the need to insert it into the time period of the Shoftim. Say this is during the Shvot HaShoftim. I think there's a lot of meaning there. The fact that they're choosing to put it in during the time period of the Shoftim specifically, even though practically what would have changed in the narrative had it been in, you know, Sefer Yehoshua, probably nothing. I think it's very telling. I think it tells us a lot about what the relationship between Megillat Rut and Sefer Shoftim is. It's not just, oh, different genres, two different books, but it's actually a very substantive relationship. And I think the best way to demonstrate this is through a tremendous amount of linguistic parallels between Megillat Rut and Sefer Shoftim. There's tons. I'm going to show you in a few minutes just pages of them. And it's very clear that the two are meant to be intertwined. But before we go and delve into these parallels and then talking about how Rut plays off of Shoftim, I want to restate sort of our essential thesis to our study thus far of Rut. And then I want to provide a background to all of Sefer Shoftim, an overview. Our thesis, or our central argument for this entire series has been, is that Rut can't be as part of Sefer Shoftim because it's a response to Shoftim. It's how you remedy all of the ills in society in Sefer Shoftim. And therefore, it needs to be situated in Shoftim to show that it's a response, but it also needs to be entirely separate to be a remedy to show that this is how you transition out of this terrible time period of Shoftim to get you to a better time. Monarchy, Sefer Shmuel, that's what we'll get to later on. But let's, before we really go into it, I want to give an overview of Shoftim. I know some of the members of our shiur here have just recently learned Shoftim, so I'm wary of saying anything incorrectly, so please feel free to correct me if I say something wrong, but I'll try to give a brief overview of Shoftim. At the beginning, so it's the second book of Navi. The first book is Yehoshua, and Yehoshua is a pretty good time. Yehoshua, they mostly conquer what they're supposed to conquer. There are a few bad episodes. They, you know, take the plunder of a city they shouldn't have in one case, and they get tricked by the Givonim. But for the most part, Yehoshua is very successful. And actually, in the Psukim, there are sort of songs or praises about this time being a successful one. And then by the end of the book, there's this whole ceremony, and people commit to God, and people commit to taking over the land, and that's where we end Sefer Yehoshua. At the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, though, things totally turn, because the first pasuk talks about how Yehoshua dies, and now the people are bereft, they're lost. Who is going to take over as a leader? And God says to them, Yehuda Ya'aleh, Yehuda is going to go up, he's going to take over as your leader. At the beginning, this actually does happen. For a little bit, Yehuda kind of goes up in the first chapter, but for the most part, Yehuda fails in their mission. They do not take over the leadership. And I think for the first maybe 20 psukim of Sefer Shoftim, they do their job. They take over the necessary lands. They drive out the inhabitants of Canaan and with their avodah zarah, their idolatry. But then the second half of the first chapter and on talks about how they did not drive out the inhabitants of the land. And over again, we see in the Torah that when you don't drive out the inhabitants of the land, you're going to fall prey to their acts of promiscuity. You're going to fall prey to avodah zarah, to idolatry, and Bnei Israel will fall prey to all this in Sefer Shoftim. Let's continue. So then we'll skip over a little bit of Parakbet, but we have a good leader, Otniel, who's actually from Yehuda, most likely. But then we get to Ehud. Ehud, if any of you remember the story with the person who stabs their sword into the man, it doesn't go through the other side because he's so fat. So that's the story of Ehud and Eglon. That is also a positive story. But then we get to Devorah and Barak. And Devorah and Barak, we already see a little bit of splintering of society, because in Devorah's song about Barak and Bnei Israel beating their enemies in battle, she complains about how not all of Bnei Israel came with them. She complains, she criticizes certain tribes for not joining with them. That's right, we see a little bit of the beginning of the situation unraveling. Then we get to Gidon in Parak Vav, Parak Zion, and Gidon also has some successes, but there's friction in, there's certainly friction. He almost has a civil war. Two is Sukkot and Penuel don't give him and his soldiers food when they desire it, or when they ask for it, when they're tired from fighting on behalf of Bnei Israel. And Gidon builds an idol at the end. It's a kind of a shocking story, but then we see religiously there's a decline as well. Then there's Avimelech. Avimelech, who's the next shofet, the next judge, he kills 70 of his siblings and leaves alive like one lame one. So that's a pretty horrible story in Shoftim. You see the sort of how families are disintegrating. You see the deterioration of society. Then later we have, there are little Shoftim throughout it. There's like minor judges that happen, but we'll skip over those. Then you have Yiftach. Yiftach also has family drama. He gets kicked out of his family. Then they bring him back because he's the one that's going to be able to fight on behalf of Bnei Israel. And Yiftach does this act where Yiftach has this famous neder, this vow. He says, whoever comes out of this house, I'm going to make them an offering. And unfortunately, who comes out? His daughter. And whether or not he actually sacrifices her, she's, whether in a literal sense or a metaphorical sense, she's a korban, she's a sacrifice. Yiftach actually has a civil war. They kill, I believe, 42,000 of their fellow Israelites in that battle. So we see, again, deterioration of society, of social dynamics. Then we get to the famous Shimshon. And Shimshon is perhaps like the last hope in Shoftim. Chronologically, he might actually be the last one. And Shimshon, there's some good times. There's a time of 20 years where he's pretty good. But for the most part, Shimshon fails. And he falls prey to his desires. He gets tempted by Delilah, and he gets sold out by Israelites themselves. And Shimshon is, by the end of it, famously, he takes down the whole building with him. He kills many people. He essentially commits suicide. And that gets us up to the last two chapters, the last two stories of Sefer Shoftim. In chapters 17 to 18, there's a story about Pesel Micha. Basically what happens is, and it's kind of the shocking story, because it's a lot of irony playing out during it. Basically the son steals money from his mother. His mother curses whoever stole the money. He returns it to her. And then she's like, oh, you should be blessed for this. Then after that, she's like, okay, this money's going to God. And what does she do with it? She builds a sort of an idol. And then they set up this like alternative temple, and they have a Levi come and be the minister there, and they have an ephod. It's like this bizarre counter to sort of the Mishkan. It's kind of like this parallel, in a weird way, it's its own separate temple of sorts. And then the people of Dan come and they basically murder a city that didn't need to be murdered, or maybe shouldn't have been. And then they steal this, this idol from Micha, and they go and they basically set up again a sort of an alternative to the Mishkan. Throughout Sefer Shoftim, you don't hear anything about the Mishkan. In Joshua, we do hear about it. In Shmuel, that's the first thing we hear about, basically. But in Shoftim, we don't hear about it till the very end of the 18th parak, and that's sort of as it's supposed to be a contrast. That here, you know, this is like the alternative to the Mishkan. And actually, very interestingly, at the end of Shoftim, they have to like give detailed directions to how to get to the Mishkan. The point is that it's so foreign to them, the Mishkan, that it's kind of like they don't even know where to go, which is shocking. And this is again, this is religious deterioration. And then finally, we get to perhaps two of the most devastating stories in Nach, horrifying, frankly. And that is chapters 19 to 21. And that's the story of Pelegish Begiva and the resultant war between the tribe of Binyamin and the rest of Bnei Israel. That is the worst civil war in Jewish history. Almost, an entire tribe is nearly wiped out. Binyamin ends up with 600 people left in their tribe, 600 men, and they're genuinely at risk of being completely wiped out. But I want to do is I want to show you how the last three chapters of Sefer Shoftim, specifically those, Pelegish Begiva, the story of the concubine, and the story of the civil war are deeply intertwined with Megillat Ruth. So let's summarize now that we got through that. Oh, now you don't even need to learn Sefer Shoftim anymore. We got through the whole thing 8 minutes or so. But the story of Pelegish Begiva is a horrifying story. And we'll speak about it outside, and then maybe we'll look at it a little bit inside. Let me open it up to it. Okay. Here's what happens. This, and note that there's no names here. Basically no names. So there's this guy who from Ish Levi, who's Pelegish likely, is Mizaneh, who maybe cheats on him, and she leaves him. And then he goes after his Pelegish, his concubine, to try to get her back. And he goes and she's staying at her father's house, and she goes, and he goes to be with her. And then the concubine's father lets him in and they stay there a few days. And then finally, they leave and they go to Giva, or they're traveling and it gets dark, and so they decide to go stay at in Giva. And what happens? So there's nowhere to stay. There's this concern that there's nowhere to stay until they find this one man who b'nei ish zaken ba min maaseu min asadeh ba'arev. And so they go, the Benjamites, and they go and they say to this man, you know, we have our own supplies, please just let us stay with you. And the man says, yeah, you could stay with us. I think it's very interesting. We'll get back to that in a moment. We'll see how it's fascinating that they need to convince him by saying, oh, we have supplies already, please let us stay with you. They go to this guy's house. And then he's very generous with the man, not with the concubine. And all of a sudden, in the middle of at night, what happens? The people of the town come and gather around the house, and they say, give us this man. He says, give us this man, and we want to basically rape him. And the man says to them, the host says to them, no. He says, I'll give you the concubine, and I'll give you my own daughter. Horrifying, right? So what happens? The husband of the concubine basically throws the concubine out, and the men rape her the entire night. The men of the Binyamin men rape her the entire night. And in this horrible, this horrible imagery, she basically gets to the front steps of the house after she goes through this ordeal, and she collapses there and she dies. And what happens? The man wakes up in the morning. It's kind of like, you know, this is happening. He's, you know, oh, in the morning he's going to go look. And he opens the door of the house, and what happens? Bine isha pilag show nofela petach abayev yadeh al asaf. Basically, she's standing, she's lying down on the floor of the house, and her hands, basically, you can think of like her hands are like on the doorknob, and she's dead. And what happens? He takes her, he chops her up into 12 pieces, and sends it out, sends every piece of her to the different tribes of Bnei Israel. And basically, the psukim at the end says that Vayakol haroah, everyone who saw this said, lo niyata, lo niyata kazot, there was nothing ever like this from Mitzrayim until now. This was a singular event. It was unique in terms of how terrible it was. That's the story of Pelegas Begiva. As a result of that, they all team up against Binyamin, and they go after Binyamin, and they eventually, after two tries, are able to basically kill off all of them until they get down to 600, and they figure out a way to get some of these Benjamites married so they aren't entirely wiped out. I want to show you just very briefly, because you'll have to trust me mostly, how many parallels there are between these two stories. This is taken from my teacher, Dr. Yael Ziegler's book. And just if you take a moment to look here, how many parallels there are between these two stories. It says, Vayelech acharel adaber aliba, dibart alev shifchatecha, vayochlu, vayishtu, vayocha boaz, and just keep going down and down. Some of the most famous words in Megillat Ruth. They talk about the men of the soldiers going out to battle. They say, call them Anshei Chayil, Rut, Anshei Gibor Chayil, Eshet Chayil, Ish Gibor Chayil, Eshet Chayil At. More and more and more, you'll see the 10 men, Allah, over and over again. This is the pages of this. Right? There's so much parallel linguistically between these two stories. And I want to try to understand through the lens of some of what we've talked about, the relationship between why is there this parallel? Why are these two stories deeply intertwined? Why does Megillat Ruth need to be situated in Sefer Shoftim? So let's go through some of the things we've talked about in this series. First of all, we talked about Ruth being a tikkun, a remedy for the sins of Lot. If you remember, in the first chapter, we spoke about how Lot basically abandons the path of Abraham. He goes down to Sodom, even with good intentions. And he gets totally trapped there. He ends up almost giving out his own daughters to this mob that wants to rape his guests. And he, in the end, ends up sleeping with his own daughters, and that leads to Ammon and Moab. And Ammon and Moab are nations of immorality and nations of that are not kind, that they're not generous. They don't give food to Bnei Israel. On their way. So we spoke about how Ruth is a tikkun for Lot. In contrast to Lot, who's, his descendants are Moab, who goes to Sodom, what does Ruth do? Ruth goes to the nation of Israel. She clings along with Naomi, right? And we spoke about, flashback, right? Lech lecha me'artzcham l'adcham beit avicha by Abraham. And then Boaz refers to Ruth as leaving Batazvi Avich v'Yimeich v'Eretz Moladetech v'Telchi El Am Asher Lo Yadata Timol Shel Shom. Boaz describes Ruth as an Abraham character. She returns to the path of Abraham. And we said that Ruth is redeeming Lot, the mistakes that Lot made of leaving Abraham, of going to a terrible place like Sodom, even though he thinks he can handle it. If there's one story in Tanakh that reminds us of Sodom, it's the story we just discussed. And that's the story of Pelegas Begiva. Mm-hmm. What I want to try to argue for the next few minutes is that Ruth is not only atoning for the sin of Lot and showing the way of getting back to the path of Abraham, it's Bnei Israel who have landed in the position of being like Sodom. They have become Sodom-like. They have become like Ammon and Moab, the descendants of Lot, essentially the spiritual heirs to Sodom. Bnei Israel also needs to be redeemed because they have become the new Sodom. Just a few parallels. And this is, this is very common to point this out. Talk about Sodom. What happens? They bring in the guests. It says, V'linu v'rachatzu raglechem. Lot says to them, wash your feet, v'rachatzu. Later in Pelegas Begiva, they say, v'yirchatzu. They say, oh, we'll sleep on the street in Sodom. And they say, don't sleep in the street. Same thing in Pelegas Begiva. He brings them to this house. Vayavo el beito and vayochelu, and they eat. Again, parallel after parallel. I think it's also very strong. Anshei ha'ir nasabu, the people of Sodom surrounded al habayit, the house. And they said, bring him out. And they said, bring hotzieh meleinu. V'nei da'ah utam, so we can know them in a sexual sense. Also here in Megillat Ruth, in Sefer Shoftim, Hotzeya Ta'ish, bring out this man, V'nei De'enu, so we can know him. There's tons of more, but I just want to give a few more examples. Lot says, Vayitzei Aleihem, Vayitzei Aleihem. It's clear that they're trying to make the two parallel. says al na achai tareyu al achai al tareyu ba banor shaloya lo yadu ish otzia na hen otzia na otam, right? It's and then finally the asu lahem atobe nechem the asu lahen katobe nechem. You see, these two stories are deeply intertwined. B'nei Yisrael, during the time of Shoftim, during the story of Plagas B'Giva, has become like Sodom. And they also need redeeming. I go a step further. The Psukim themselves are trying to demonstrate that they have strayed from the path of Abraham. What do I mean? I came across this today. I think it's very strong. The only two times in Tanakh, this I don't know offhand, but I saw this. The only two times in Tanakh where it mentions the word ma'achelet are by Avraham Avinu, when he takes the ma'achelet, this sort of sword to shecht Yitzchak at the Akedah. You know the other time where it talks about it? By Avo El Beito, he brings him to the house, by Kach et ha-ma'achelet, he takes his concubine wife, he takes her and he cuts her up with the ma'achelet. So, that you see the connection between the two stories. Here in Avram, Vayochlu Shnehem Yachdav. Here it's Vayochlu Shnehem Yachdav. A little different, but you hear it. The Shnehem Yachdav. Vayashkim Avraham Baboker. Here it's in Pilagos B'Giva, Vayashkim Baboker. And then Avram provides his guest, Bechap HaLechem B'Sa'adu Libchem. Eat, let me give you some bread. And what happens? He says, "Saad libcha pat lechem ba'achar teilecho." In the father of the concubine says that again and again. And finally, I think what's really fascinating here is the following: we talked about how Moab, the reason why Moab can't come into the nation of Hashem, come into Bnei Israel, is because they did not give bread to Bnei Israel. I copied down the wrong pasuk, but you'll have to trust me on this one. But not only because they didn't provide, they weren't generous to Bnei Israel. Here's what I think is very interesting. Not only does Bnei Israel become like Sodom, but they also become like the spiritual descendants of Sodom, the literal descendants of Lot, like Ammon and Moab. We know Moab from two places in Tanakh. The first is they don't give food to Bnei Israel, and the second is that they're sexually promiscuous. They seduce Bnei Israel. That's the story of Pinchas, which we won't get into now. Those two traits appear in Sefer Shoftim too. They have abandoned the path of Abraham, gone to Sodom, and the same way Ruth is remedying or the tshuvah for Lot, she's a tshuvah or the method for how Bnei Israel can get out of their problems in Shoftim. I think what's fascinating is that there's this parallel between Bereshit, where Rivka tells Eved Abraham that we have plenty for you, come sleep at our house, we have plenty to give you. Gam tevim, gam ispo, gam rav yimana, we have a lot of stuff, we also have a place for you to sleep. What happens in Sefer Shoftim? The husband of the concubine needs to tell the guy, please let us stay, we have food, we can supply ourselves, we can handle ourselves. I think that's fascinating. One story is Rivka, the generous, to be the daughter-in-law of Abraham, because she represents kindness as well. There in Bereshit, she's offering in Shoftim, Plagish B'Givah, they need to try to prove why you should be able to take us in as guests. They need to say, the status quo, a priori, what would we assume? They wouldn't have taken them in because they didn't have supplies. It turns out he would have anyways, but I think the thought is shocking. Just to drive this home a step further, Gidon, in the 8th chapter of Shoftim, tries to get food from Sukkot and Penuel, two different places, because they need, they're exhausted. And you know what happens? Sukkot says no. And they say, Penuel says no. That caused a lot of friction. But Bnei Israel has turned into the stingy nature of Moab. They haven't, they no longer embody Abraham, the path of Chesed. And I think the second point as well, the notion about Sodom and Moab being sexually immoral and being promiscuous, I think that shows up again in Sefer Shoftim, certainly by Pilagos B'Givah, where they rape this concubine, certainly the concubine herself, who maybe is Mizaneh under her husband, and also by Shimshon. By Shimshon it says, Vayelech Shimshon Azat, it's sort of like matter of fact that it says this, and he sees Vayar Sham Yishazona, he sees a harlot, by Avraham Lao, and he has relations with her. Bnei Israel is turned into these Ammon and Moab. It's turned into Sodom. And that's why we need Ruth, who abandons the path of the path of Sodom and returns to Avraham. She latches onto Naomi. And also we need Boaz, right? Because what is Boaz? Boaz represents sexual morality, right? Boaz, instead of sleeping with Ruth in the third chapter, with this woman lying at his feet, so easy, just like Yehuda and Tamar, just like Lot and his own daughters, what instead does Boaz do? He recognizes Ruth. He chooses not to fall prey to the seduction. And through that, I think Boaz as well is the remedy, is the tikkun for Bnei Israel for falling prey to the path of Sodom, to the path of Ammon and Moab. That's the first theme I wanted to revisit. The second, conjoin them just for the sake of time. The second thing I wanted to mention was in the second and third chapters, we talked a lot about how the importance of recognizing someone else, of dignifying them, of respecting them, and recognizing them as a human being. We spoke about how not only, what is perhaps Boaz's greatest kindness to Ruth? It's recognizing Ruth. She says, Lama li lahakirini, why have you recognized me? Banochi nachriya, and I'm just a foreigner, I'm a stranger. Her experience in the fields that people don't recognize her, they don't treat her well, they don't, the overseer, if you remember, describes her as this Moavia, she's a stranger. And what does Boaz do? Boaz recognizes her. He recognizes her as a person. He tries to upgrade her. He lets her reap in the fields. He lets her eat with his higher level workers. And in the third chapter, we mentioned how Mi'at, Boaz says to Ruth, who are you? It's not just this nameless individual, this stranger, this outcast, but it's someone, they're a human being, and to recognize that. That's what Boaz does. And I think that perhaps the greatest sign of the greatest sign of recognizing someone, and we won't need to describe this more at length because we mentioned it quite a few times, is that names, not numbers, right? When you recognize someone by their name and that they're a person, they're not just, oh, this Moabite woman. It's a way of showing respect. It's a way of treating them not as an object. It's not they're this nothing. It's a way of treating them as a subject, as a human being, as a person. If there's one place where names get removed and there's no more names, it is in Perek Yotet and on of Sefer Shoftim. There's no longer a sense of recognition of everyone else. If you think about what happens in Sefer Shoftim, it's total social deterioration, right? There's a civil war. They rape a concubine. She gets cut up like an object. They don't help each other out. There's a civil war earlier on, and much more. But if you look, right, there's no names, right? Throughout this entire story, it's because people don't have respect for each other anymore. They don't care to recognize the other. That's the story of Pilagish Begiva. It's this total social deterioration over and over again, right? That, they don't go out to help each other in Sefer Shoftim. They don't treat each other with respect. There's so much more to say. It's a 21 chapter book, but I think just even from these last few chapters of the Pilegesh, the nameless Pilegesh, the object, right? They cut her up. She's an object, right? She's nameless. They treat her as a sexual object. And the fact that everyone in this story is basically nameless, and then they destroy Binyamin. I think I think it says a lot about their social cohesion. I think it says a lot about why does that happen? It's a lack of respect, a lack of care for the other in society. I'd add that the last point we mentioned, or second to last point we mentioned the previous year, was the bracha they give to the kid of Ruth is V'karei Shemo B'Yisrael. Can I talk about what exactly that bracha means? Could it mean that it's just to make his name famous? Or maybe it's just itself, a blessing to call someone by a name. Yikarei Shemo B'Yisrael. Two more themes. Let's try to mention two more themes before we wrap up. And again, you're seeing how what we've discussed in our Shiurim, these individual ideas we developed in Ruth, are really all about this broader theme of how Ruth is a response to Shoftim, had it to be a tikkun, a remedy for all the ills that, or for some of the ills we find there. Say for Shmuel will be a remedy for some of the religious problems in Sefer Shoftim. Maybe we'll mention just one or two more. In the fourth chapter of Shoftim, the Milat Mancha, the light word, one of them was a Geula, redemption. And what redemption really means is taking responsibility for the other. It's a sense of loyalty, a sense of commitment. I think you see this throughout Sefer Megillat Rut. Rut is sort of unnecessarily loyal to Naomi. She goes out of her way to help her, even though she doesn't necessarily deserve it, Naomi. Maybe she doesn't even appreciate it to some extent. And Rut is an example of extreme loyalty and kindness and devotion to family, especially. But I think Boaz also, in the fourth chapter, is the one who takes responsibility for Rut. He arranges the whole scene, and then he ends up providing with a kid. And Boaz is the redeemer, Hakim Shem Hamit, right? He's the one who establishes the name of the other. And there's a sense of responsibility and commitment, perhaps loyalty to one another in Megillat Rut. What happens in Sefer Shoftim? So I think the best example of this is what happens at the end, where there's no sense of loyalty of what happens. They destroy an entire tribe. And there's no sense of commitment to the other. Throughout the book, there's, as we mentioned, there's a lot of times they're trying to get the tribes to work together and it doesn't happen. Yiftach, just the family unit breaks down. Yiftach gets kicked out of the house. Avimelech kills 70 of his siblings. Again and again, in Shoftim, is the breakdown of loyalty, of families, of commitment. I think Rut and Boaz, Rut is the ultimate, embodiment of chesed, of kindness, in the way she treats Naomi. And Boaz is taking responsibility for Rut, and Boaz, being loyal to her. I think he also is this redemptive force. He's a response to Sefer Shoftim as well. Finally, just one cute one. It's not actually so cute. It's actually pretty terrible, but it's cute in one sense. And Yehuda, at the beginning of the book, is the one who's supposed to go up. At the very end, they don't really. At the end of the book, when the nations of Israel are asking God, how should we go defeat Binyamin? You know what God says to them? He says, Yehuda Ya'ala. And it's the sort of horrifying, sort of irony that Yehuda was originally supposed to go up to conquer the land so they could take it over and have a wonderful society. Now Yehuda is supposed to be the one going up. Perhaps as a result of their failure initially, Yehuda is the one going up to basically murder or kill their brethren. Who's the one from Yehuda that's Allah in Sefer Rut, in Megillat Rut? Anybody catch this? Who in Megillat Rut is Allah? I'll give you a little hint. It's beginning of chapter 4. Who is it? Uboaz Allah Hashar. Boaz, who we know is the judge, he's a shofet of the time, presumably. Boaz is Allah. And where is Boaz from? Mibei Lechem Yehuda, right? Mishpach Elimelech. We know Elimelech is from Bei Lechem Yehuda. So in a sense, Boaz is filling this leadership void that was so necessary in Shoftim that was missing and so necessary in Shoftim. And Boaz, the man from Yehuda, steps up and takes on that responsibility. Perhaps to conclude, the ultimate point in Megillat Rut is the contrast to the last part of Sefer Shoftim. Over and over again, I think about maybe 4 or 5 times, at the end of Shoftim, the book describes the anarchy in society, the lack of moral values, everyone doing what they wanted. And the Pasuk by Amim Ahim, in those days, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, there was no king in Israel. Ish HaYashar B'Einav Yaseh, every person did what was right in his own eyes. It's a story of immorality, a story of anarchy, no commitment towards the other. But what's the problem? By Amim Ahim, Ein Melech B'Yisrael. In those days, there was no king in Israel. What happens at the end of Megillat Rut? What's the tikkun? How does Rut remedy the problems of Sefer Shoftim? It's not only all the things we mentioned before, although clearly it is very important that those are a part of it, but it's also that it provides kingship. And to loop back to our first year, kingship is built off of kindness. It's devotion to others, self sacrifice, and through that story, we end up in Rut with a final pasuk. Boved holid at Yishai, Yishai holid at David. What do we end up with? David HaMelech, the Davidic dynasty. Not the first king, but Beis David Mishlichecha. David is going to be the one, and his descendants are going to be the kings for eternity. And we see how not only is, you know, Megillat Rut sort of a response to all these specific themes, but it's also getting to the point of kingship, which is supposed to remedy, I guess, in the most significant way, the problems of Sefer Shoftim, where there's no unified leadership. I want to just bolster this point with maybe two other psukim. And just interestingly, Josephus and the Septuagint, I forgot how you pronounce it, my apologies, Targum HaShivim in Hebrew, they place Megillat Rut in the corpus of Tanakh, in the canon. They put it between Shoftim and Sefer Shmuel. Sefer Shmuel is the third book of the prophets. Now, Rut is in the Ketuvim, it's in the Megillah. So where do we see this connection between Rut and Shmuel? And I think the point is that you're going to see that Rut is connected to Shmuel, and it's important because Rut is supposed to bring you from Shoftim, from that time, to the book of Shmuel, to the time of monarchy, to hopefully a much more prosperous and successful time under monarchy. And it's going to be complicated, but monarchy, at least at this point, has become the ideal. What am I talking about? There are two times in Tanakh where a certain phrase is used. The end of Megillat Rut, "Va'yalachal meishiv nefesh." This is talking about the son of Rut and Boaz. So it talks about all these blessings, and you know he should help you in your old age, and all these other nice things. And this grandson Tanami, asher he tova lach. That grandson is, or now it's referring to Rut, sorry, Mishiva Banim, is greater than seven sons. Okay, the Shiva is not so important to me. Tova lach mi blank banim. And seven in Tanakh is a very important number. What happens to Sefer Shmuel? Where else do you see this phrase come up? Where do you see this connection between Rut and Shmuel? The other time, when Elkanah says to Chana, Chana's crying, she's barren, and Elkanah says to her, "Why are you so crying? Am I not your wonderful, amazing husband? Halo anochi tov lach me'asara banim. Am I not better than 10 sons to you?" So you see, Rut is connected to Shmuel. It's connected to the book, which is going to lead to monarchy. Finally, just another one. Yaseim Hashem lecha zera min ha'isha hazot. In Shmuel, the other time, min ha'zera asher yitin Hashem lecha min ha'ara hazot. This connection, again, Rut is supposed to take you from Shoftim to the time of monarchy, and it's supposed to be the tikkun for the ills of society in Shoftim. I think as we get to Shavuot, maybe just on a homiletic note, as we've been doing a lot of pshat up to this time, sort of on a homiletic note, you know, we get to Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, and it's with Kolot Brakim, with thunder and lightning, and you know, that's important. That's part of the experience. But I think what drives society, and maybe what we need to take from Megillat Rut, is how do you get from this horrible time of Shoftim to monarchy? It's not with these big, dramatic, massive stories. It's not with thunder and lightning. It's the little acts of kindness people do to each other. And that's what Rut is about. It's these acts of kindness. I think that, as we process Matan Torah and all that it stands for and realize the gravity of the experience, you have to remember that, you know, how we get to a better society is, of course, all the parts of the Torah, but also remembering the recognizing the stranger, showing kindness towards others, providing people with names, of taking responsibility and loyalty to families, and so much more that we've learned together in Megillat Rut. So I wish you all a Mazel Tov, Hadron Alach Megillat Rut. I hope you guys have enjoyed this half as much as how I've enjoyed giving it, because this has been wonderful. I've gained a lot from it, and I hope you have as well. And, we're hoping I'll be around next year at Beis Shalom once again. And, some people have already expressed interest about, what we'll do next. So we'll put some thought into that. And I look forward to learning with you in the future, hopefully in person. But I wish you all well. Thank you so much for coming. And it's really been a tremendous pleasure learning with you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.